This time on your weekly Constitutional.
We're very worried that if the court becomes an institution that is seen by, a large percentage of the population as just another partisan institution, that's bad for the court, it's bad for the rule of law, and it's bad for our constitutional system.
That was Ganesh Sitaraman, who teaches at the law school at Vanderbilt University. He and his co-authors have come out with a new article called How to Save the Supreme Court. That's a pretty ambitious title, but Ganesh and his co-authors have some very interesting ideas. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about saving the Supreme Court.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
The federal judiciary is supposed to be different, fundamentally different from the other two branches of our national government. The Congress and the President are voted into office to go forth and do good. But judges have to wait for cases to come to them, and they have no independent mechanism for enforcing their decrees and their decisions. They depend upon the other branches of government, the respect of those branches, and more broadly, the respect of the American people in order to do their jobs. And that's why it's so troubling to so many people these days that the legitimacy of the federal judiciary and specifically of the U.S. Supreme Court are increasingly called into question. Judges are dismissed as Republican appointees or Democratic appointees or Obama judges or Bush judges. If the public starts to see the court merely as another political body, will it stop paying attention to the court's decisions? Will the other branches of government refuse to enforce those decrees? Well, those are the dangers. Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor at Vanderbilt University, and he and his co-authors have decided to look into how the court might be fixed. Indeed, how the court might be saved.
I'm Ganesh Sitaraman. I'm a professor at Vanderbilt Law School and the director of the program on law and government. And I teach constitutional law. I teach courses on regulation and legislation and foreign affairs law, which is all the constitutional law issues related to foreign policy, like war powers and treaties.
Well, then there are just a plethora of issues that you and I could discuss today. But the particular one is one that I noticed in Vox Online, which is apparently a summary of a new article you've got coming up in the Yale Law Journal. Can you tell me what's the problem you're trying to fix?
Yeah, the article is called How to Save the Supreme Court.
And that's a very ambitious title.
It is. And it's co-authored with Dan Epps, who's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And our concern in the paper is that the Supreme Court faces a pretty serious legitimacy crisis. This is a crisis that has a number of different sources. The first, and the one that's probably most evident to people who are listening today, is the appointments process that we've just witnessed over the last few years. First, there was the nomination of Merrick Garland by Barack Obama to the court. And in a really unprecedented fashion, that nomination didn't even make it to a hearing, let alone a vote, despite Judge Garland's relative centrism and supreme qualifications and all the traditional metrics for a Supreme Court justice. And the reason for that was that Senator McConnell and Republicans blocked that nomination in order to try to preserve the 5-4 partisan balance of the court, or at least ideological balance of the court, in favor of Republicans in hopes that a Republican would be elected in 2016. That obviously happened. And we got Justice Gorsuch out of that process. The second nomination
Before we go on, Ganesh, now that was very controversial. And I believe it was a break with norms that go back centuries, but it was technically constitutional, wasn't it?
So it is technically I think there are debates about how we want to think about the process of what advising consent involves. But there's been a longstanding norm, certainly, that presidents get to appoint, nominate justices to the Supreme Court, and that those justices should get a fair hearing and be considered. And that has been with us for a long time. And so I think the departure from that long standing set of practices. And, you know, this is the action from Senator McConnell is something that scholars have called constitutional hardball, kind of playing a real form of political hardball with things that have constitutional stakes. That's the kind of thing that I think is the first aspect of our kind of recent legitimacy crisis in the court, where there's a lot of people who thought that process was unfair and problematic because elections are supposed to have consequences, including presidents being able to appoint justices to the court. The second one, just to get it out there, is we just went through this this nomination of Judge Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit, who became a Supreme Court justice this year. And this process, you know, did not have to be an illegitimate one. The departure of Justice Kennedy was one that followed the traditional process. He retired. And as a result, as president, Donald Trump was entitled to nominate a new justice. What emerged, however, was a process that had hearings that, you know, many in the country saw as deeply problematic because of both the kind of investigations into potential conduct that happened when Judge Kavanaugh was in high school, but also just because of Judge Kavanaugh's responses in the hearings to senators, which many, including some pretty distinguished commentators, thought were potentially disqualifying for the court because they showed a lack of judicial temperament. The consequence, I think, of both of these nominations is that there's a lot of people in the country who feel like the Supreme Court has a legitimacy problem, that it's got two justices that maybe don't deserve to be there. And more broadly, that what we're seeing is an increased partisanship on the court. You know, we've had a court that for a long time had 5-4 decisions, but the five included Justice Kennedy, who at least some of the time could go in both directions. And what that meant was it was at least plausible for people to think that the Supreme Court was not just another partisan body acting based on ideological or political motivations, but that there was something else that that was really about law and justice that was going on there. I think the challenge now is, as you see,
there, Ganesh,
more...
I'm going to agree with you on that very, very much, because I think Justice Kennedy especially, and of course before him Justice O'Connor, they really were willing to go the opposite way. And I think probably in Justice Kennedy's case, his position on gay rights was a marked departure from his more conservative colleagues. So I see where you're going with this. Kennedy and before him O'Connor preserved some sort of aura of legitimacy.
And the striking thing now is that what we should expect going forward is a much more ideologically committed 5-4 majority on the conservative side on the court. And you know, what's striking about this is this is pretty unique in American history. You know, going back, the period that people really talk about is where the court was at odds with the political process is leading into the time period of the New Deal. And there, there were these justices that, you know, were often called the Four Horsemen, but there were five justices who would vote against the New Deal programs. What is striking about that is that those justices were not all appointed by Republicans going against the actions of a Democratic president, Franklin Roosevelt. At least one of them was a Democrat and had been appointed by Woodrow Wilson. And so it wasn't a sense of the perfect overlap of partisanship and ideology. And I think our concern and the motivation for writing a paper with this kind of grand title on saving the Supreme Court is that we're very worried that if the court becomes an institution that is seen by, you know, a large percentage of the population as just another partisan institution, that that's bad for the court, it's bad for the rule of law, and it's bad for our constitutional system.
Well, that is quite an issue and quite a problem, and you've summarized it very, very well. Before we go on, just a comment on the Four Horsemen, who included Justice McReynolds, who was considered by many to be one of the most unpleasant, in fact, bigoted men in the history of the Supreme Court. You pointed out that he was, or at least some of the horsemen were appointments of Democratic presidents. But of course, the parties were very different then. The Democratic Party was the haven probably of most of the segregationists and most of the Jim Crow proponents, at least in the South. It had its liberal wing and its much more conservative wing, and it's similarly the Republican Party. But these days, the parties themselves have become so much more ideologically polarized. Is that what's contributing to the current problem?
I think that's right. One of the things that political scientists have shown is that we've become more and more polarized over time, over the last generation or so. And so in a time when there is considerable partisan polarization and sorting, we see this throughout our political system, and that includes in the kinds of people that presidents are nominating to the Supreme Court.
And it does undercut the legitimacy. Going back to the New Deal again, of course, in response to the Four Horsemen and the striking down of so many of the New Deal statutes in the early 30s, you had Roosevelt actually considering, very actively considering, a court packing plan in the spring of 1937, which was, of course, obviated to some extent by the decision in 1937 in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish and the switch of Justice Roberts. We've talked about that on the show many times. So there is a history of the politicization of the Supreme Court. In fact, I think even the reduction of the number of justices from 10 to 9, and even before that, attempts to impeach Supreme Court justices during the founding era. So is this really such a unique situation? Haven't we been down this road before?
Yeah, throughout our history, the Supreme Court has at times been seen as a partisan institution or the kind of province of one ideological side or the other. And this has caused a lot of outrage in the political process, and there have been moves to try to change the court size, change its composition, pack the courts, and that is something that has happened at important junctures in our history. And you know, I think one of the things that we're seeing now is people are concerned that the shenanigans that led to the current composition of the court, particularly around the Garland nomination, are leading to renewed calls for significant changes to the court. We've proposed some in our paper, but you know, the maybe most prominent one that you hear is packing the court again, so expanding the size of the court so that the next president can put in new justices in order to correct for the flaws in the process that led to the last two justices.
Before we get to your proposals, let's just talk about that, because I'm hearing more and more of that. In fact, I'm hearing much more broadly that Democrats are planning on expanding the federal judiciary generally, because right now the Republicans, again, in violation of a number of longstanding norms, are expediting the process of appointing lower federal judges, both at the trial and especially the appellate levels. Let's talk a little bit about that. Is there any constitutional problem with expanding the size of the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court, and then allowing more left-leaning judges to be appointed in the future?
So in general, the number of judges on both the lower courts and in the Supreme Court is something that Congress can set, and that's by statute. And that number has changed over the years. You mentioned it earlier, you know, in the 1860s, shifting from 10 to 9. So this number is one that's fluctuated both at the Supreme Court level and at the lower court level. In fact, the lower courts have not always been organized the way they are today, with a set of circuits, a panel system, and appeals en banc and so on. For the first 100 years of the country, we had a system where Supreme Court justices would ride circuit and travel around to different parts of the country hearing cases alongside judges. And so there's been different models throughout our history for how this has been organized. And the Constitution doesn't set any particular structure or number in place. It leaves that to Congress to fill out the details of how the judiciary will be designed and set up.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Ganesh Sitaraman, who teaches law at Vanderbilt University, and who has written an article that's going to be published in the Yale Law Journal here quite shortly about how to save the Supreme Court. Now, there's something worth doing. Stick around. It's Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm discussing how to save the Supreme Court. Ganesh Sitaraman of Vanderbilt Law School, who along with his co-author Daniel Epps of the Washington University School of Law, has written a new article that will shortly be published in the Yale Law Journal. So it's perfectly constitutional. In fact, I think the only federal judge who's mentioned at all specifically in the Constitution is the Chief Justice himself or herself. And so theoretically, Congress could simply not authorize any other judicial positions and we could have a Supreme Court composed of one person.
Well, I think there'd be some. I would suspect that a lot of scholars would debate that question, whether you could really have a court just of one. You're right that the Chief Justice is mentioned, particularly because the Chief Justice presides over a trial of the president in the case of after there's been an impeachment, if there's the opportunity for removing a president from office in the Senate. But I think there would be some concern about that. You know, one of the things that is an important argument in constitutional law, as you know, is what our historical practice has been. And I think that's one of the strong arguments that a lot of people raise about how we think about the size of the court. And yes, the court has changed over time. But we've also had some continuities over time in how we think about the court, and that should weigh heavily upon us. And we shouldn't try to make big changes unless we really think they're important. And that's where we kind of come down in our paper, is that, you know, we want to be serious about the nature of the crisis and what could be at stake. But we need to be thoughtful about the kind of solutions that we push forward, too, because there's a lot at stake in that as well.
Oh, absolutely. And as you point out, the norm has always been that we've had a federal judiciary, and it's been composed of more than one chief justice. I mean, I think one of the first things the first Congress did in the Judiciary Act of 1789 was create the federal court system on the circuit basis, as you described later, and then it evolved over time. History and tradition and prior practice are important concepts in constitutional law, and indeed a massive restructuring of the federal judiciary and the court itself would probably be seen as a very partisan act on behalf or by a future Democratic Senate and president. So it wouldn't really solve the problem of legitimacy, even though it might make Democrats happy for a while. And then Republicans could do the same thing when they got back in office a few decades later or a few years later. So, okay, that's not necessarily a good solution, packing the federal judiciary. So we come finally to your proposals. What are they?
Yeah. So in this paper, we propose two options for how we might think about reforming the court. The first option is a lottery system. So the idea here is that you expand the size of the Supreme Court by appointing every court of appeals judge to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court. So now you've got a Supreme Court of about 180, and the Supreme Court would hear cases in panels of nine chosen randomly from all the court of appeals judges. And the justices on the Supreme Court would hear oral argument for 2 weeks at a time. You know, they'd prepare beforehand in their chambers. They'd work on the opinions afterwards. But they would be on the hook for about 2 weeks' worth of oral arguments. And our argument is that this would have some very beneficial effects. First, we would not have this politicized process of appointments constantly, because you would just be drawing from the Court of Appeals, where there's just so many more people that it would very much reduce the partisan and ideological salience of court appointments, which, you know, in our context today have really also become something that defines a lot of presidential elections. So this would hopefully take that a little bit more out of the electoral realm. You also wouldn't have a system where you have the skewing of constitutional law based on the particular idiosyncratic views of one or a few justices, because they would be randomly selected from a much larger pool. Litigants would not know which set of judges they're going to get. And as a result, they couldn't tailor arguments to try to fit the personal preferences of one judge or another. So we think that's a general benefit to constitutional law as well. You also wouldn't know which judges are going to hear which cases. So the judges won't be able to pick the cases they hear. They'll be picking cases for the future Supreme Court to hear, because they would be rotating every couple of weeks. And so that means that you couldn't really game the system either, with judges over a period of years trying to advance some sort of ideological agenda. So the hope is that together this will really tamp down the politics on the court. The second proposal we call the balanced court, and the idea here—
Can we pause there, Ganesh?
Sure.
I don't want to overload people with too much.
You've mentioned there's a lot going on there.
Very interesting ideas. So what we've got here then is no permanent Supreme Court in the sense that it currently exists. Instead, we would say that everybody who's on a federal circuit court of appeals would be simply automatically appointed as an associate justice of the court as well. So my first question is, isn't that a remarkable structural change that might be perceived as going too far in one great step?
So these are – our two proposals are both big structural changes to the court. That is certainly the case. But we think they're important and necessary changes, and that one of the really beneficial things about both of our proposals is, while they are big changes, they're changes that we think both sides, after an initial push, we think one side, you know, most likely it would be Democrats that would push a change forward like this. But after that, it's a kind of structure that both sides could live with. It's not a structure that would immediately require some sort of tit-for-tat response, because when you get to the reformed system, it's not stacking the deck in favor of one side or the other in a systematic way. So that's what we think is really important about our proposals, is that they have the potential for really lowering the temperature of these big constitutional structural fights because of how they're designed. Unlike, for example, a court packing system, where if you just expand the court and you have, you know, a Democratic president in Congress adding a couple more justices, you know, when the Republicans are in charge of the Congress and the presidency, they might add a couple more justices. Because that has the feel of really being about one side winning and the other side losing, we think our proposals don't fall into that trap to the same degree because they have a kind of neutrality in the design that both sides could live with.
So you're going big, but you're neutral. And you would not have a permanent chief justice then? Would that violate Article 3,
The chief justice would still be the chief justice and would be able to do the things that the chief justice does, including presiding over a trial of a president in the Senate and managing the logistics and operational issues that the chief justice does in the federal judiciary by statute. So that would still exist because that is a constitutional position. But the chief justice would, like all the other justices on the court, hear cases as part of the lottery system.
Okay, so any given panel would be composed of the chief justice and eight people chosen by the lottery.
No. All nine would be from the lottery. So the chief may or may not be on any given panel.
So he would not participate in a particular panel?
In the way we've thought about it, that's correct. Yeah, the chief would be part of the system because the constitutional role that the chief has is textually limited to the trial of the president and presiding over presiding over the court. And I think that's been a long tradition that we are not disrupting.
Well, that's very interesting. I don't mean to quibble, but it seems to me that if you want to talk about history and tradition, chief justices have always decided cases and they've always had a vote on a case. In fact, a very important role in assigning opinions under the current system. So how would you enforce that? If the chief justice insisted on sitting in on cases, the chief justice would sit in on the cases, wouldn't he?
Well, as I said before, you know, Congress has the power to structure how the court operates and has used that for many, many years. That is the kind of baseline from which we operate, is that Congress can do that by statute. And that's how we think the system would be designed. And, I suspect that all the actors in the process would follow Congress's, statutory outline of how the process will work, just as they do now.
Is that an argument on the exceptions and regulations clauses?
So there's a couple of places. One is a specific statement that the Congress has the ability through the exceptions and regulations clause you mentioned. Congress also has the power in Article 1 through the necessary and proper clause to implement any other powers anywhere else listed in the Constitution. So this would tie both of those together.
That's really very interesting. I hadn't understood. I guess I haven't read your complete article yet. I'm really just the summary that you published in Vox. That's very interesting. So the role of the Chief Justice would be markedly different here. He'd be the head of the federal judiciary. He'd make sure that there's toilet paper in the federal buildings around the nation, do other things like oversee the federal rules of civil procedure, that sort of thing. But he wouldn't participate in cases. That's really interesting. So you'd have nine people chosen randomly from the federal appellate courts who would decide cases. You mentioned something else. The reduction in partisanship, at least in individual appointments of these judges, because they still would have to go through a confirmation process to become federal appellate judges, you think it would be less partisan simply because of dilution. Instead of arguing over one vote out of nine, as we currently are, you'd be arguing for one vote out of 180.
You'd not only be arguing for one vote out of 180, you'd also be arguing for one vote out of 180 if they make it into a lottery where there's a fair bit of rotation every year. So the number of cases that any given Court of Appeals judge will hear as a Supreme Court justice in a given year could be pretty small, might be zero. And so that really lowers the stakes, we think, of how partisan and politically salient these nominations might become.
Really interesting. Last question on this proposal before I let you talk about your second proposal. This would have to be phased in, wouldn't it? I mean, we've got a court now with some relatively elderly but some relatively young justices. all of whom have been appointed for good behavior, which effectively means lifetime, to the current Supreme Court. What about the transition? How would you transition from that model to your model?
So our argument is that you can appoint everyone in the Court of Appeals also to be associate justices of the Supreme Court and restructure how the court operates through this kind of lottery system, and that that does not change anything about the current justices in the sense that they would still have their position for life. They would still be serving under good behavior. They would still have all their benefits and everything else. There would be no changes to any of that. The difference is they would just also be hearing many fewer cases because they would be part of the same lottery system. So it would not have that same problem. That's our argument. You know, I think there are, as I've said, for both of our proposals, we think these are constitutionally plausible proposals. That doesn't necessarily mean they're constitutionally bulletproof, but we think there are strong constitutional arguments that these could be done through statute. And so that is a change also, but we think that it does not run afoul of the good behavior requirements in the Constitution.
Boy, oh boy, if that one got challenged then and it went to the court, you'd have the current court opining and passing judgment on what many would see as a demotion. Instead of one of nine, I'm now one of 189. And if I were a current Supreme Court justice, especially one like Kavanaugh or Gorsuch, who's just been appointed, that would fundamentally change my career trajectory. I don't know how I'd feel about that. But we'll leave that to the justices in the future. So what's your second proposal, Ganesh?
So the second proposal we call the balanced court. And the idea here is that you would have five Republican justices, five Democratic justices, and those 10 would choose another five from the Court of Appeals. They would have to choose you could design it in different ways, but one approach is they would have to choose unanimously or with a very high supermajority on each side in order to have a quorum and actually be able to hear any cases. And the idea here is that what we want is to have people on the court who are well-respected, who are good jurists, and we want to reduce the kind of partisan sense that we have now. And partly requiring both sides to pick others means that they will most likely pick people that they can live with and that the other side can live with. And so we should get the types who are more moderate on the court selected for these kind of five positions when the other 10 are choosing. So that's a very different kind of approach, but that's our second idea.
That's actually very interesting. I believe you were probably inspired by a similar practice in many arbitrations, where one side gets to pick one arbitrator, the other side picks a second arbitrator, and then those two arbitrators, who are arguably biased one way or another toward a particular party, then pick a third. And again, probably somebody who's relatively neutral because they have to agree on them. Is that where you got the idea?
So that's one. There's a number of places where we thought this could work. Arbitration is one context. In a lot of agencies, it's not designed exactly the same way, but there are partisan balance requirements, which is another place where we drew some inspiration as well.
Very interesting. Okay. Well, now that you've described your ideas, let's see how they withstand a couple of challenges. The first thing that occurred to me when I read the Vox article was that this could lead to an enormous amount of instability. The Supreme Court of the United States is supposed to be, at least ideally, a source of stability, of certainly of direction, but of stability, a defender of stare decisis or, the respect for the law as it exists at the time and not moving too quickly on anything. But part of that is because you know who the nine justices are at any given moment. And so everybody can look at the court and many court watchers can predict with a fair degree of accuracy how they're going to come out in almost any decision at any given time. But now it sounds kind of like the Wild West. If I'm going to be litigating a case in a year, if my petition for cert has just been granted, I don't know who's going to be on that panel. I don't know how to structure my arguments, and I really don't know what they're going to do. Is this going to lead to instability, the abandonment of stare decisis?
It's a great question. And I think our hope is that it would actually, in some ways, there are ways we can protect against that. But in some ways, it might actually help and deepen stare decisis and improve stability. And let me explain on both fronts. First, in terms of addressing the ways in which we might address instability, I think one of the ways to do that is to have a supermajority requirement for overturning statutes. And so we've suggested that for the lottery approach especially. What you don't want in the lottery approach is to have a panel randomly selected of nine this week decide one way, and then the next week have a panel that goes the other direction. And so a supermajority requirement can help tamp that down partly. So that's one solution that we have. But the broader point, I think, is that what both of these approaches do is really reform and change the mindset of all the actors in the system. So if you take the lottery approach, for example, you know, Court of Appeals judges who spend their whole lives working on Court of Appeals cases are really looking to the court for guidance. They want the certainty. They want the stability. They like the stare decisis element that you can get from clear court decisions that provide guidance. So when they are pulled up into the Supreme Court as part of the lottery, or when the five are pulled up as part of the balanced court plan, one of the things they're going to bring to the table is a desire for that kind of decision making, because they understand on a daily basis what it would mean to have unstable, unpredictable, hard to read, hard to understand court decisions, because they're the ones on a regular basis who are relying on that guidance to decide cases. So I think there's an important piece there. I think another important piece is that for litigants, what you will have to do is make arguments based on the law rather than based on your potential sense of what the particular idiosyncratic personal views of a single swing justice might be. And I think we would hope that that is a good thing. We don't want the idiosyncratic views of a single individual to become what the Constitution means. We think it should be what the law is, and it should draw on our shared resources of history, you know, traditions, you know, all the doctrines. That is part of how we decide how we interpret the text, not based on the idiosyncratic views of a single individual today.
That's an interesting point, Ganesh, because I've heard it said that, at least up until quite recently, that if you were heading toward the Supreme Court, you wrote your brief entirely for Justice Kennedy, because he was a swing vote. He was the one you really had to peel away from the conservatives if you had a hope of winning on a more liberal case or a more liberal argument. And right now, of course, everyone's speculating that it's going to be Chief Justice Roberts who's going to be the centrist here. So I suspect most of the briefs these days are aimed at him, because they think they can predict how the other eight justices are going to vote in any one case.
Right. And in a world where you don't have predictability about who the justices are, it becomes a lot harder to tailor your arguments to the views of a particular individual.
That's really interesting. I'm reminded of the practice down in the state of Florida where I used to practice law. You didn't know who your panel was. You'd get a randomly chosen panel of your circuit court of appeals on the day of the arguments. And so smart lawyers would show up earlier in the day to see who was on the panel. You'd hope that your oral argument was scheduled later in the day, and then you'd see who was on the panel, and then you'd rush back and do a little bit of Westlaw research and see how you could tailor your arguments to appeal to those particular judges. But there's always a hint of illegitimacy about that, as you say. I mean, it should be about the law. It shouldn't just be about, you know, John or Jane or whoever's on the panel. Well, let me take the opposite tack then and play devil's advocate on this. You mentioned that you think this will lead to more stability. And I can see that. I can see that randomly chosen judges who know they're only there for 2 weeks are not going to be too eager to do too much damage to the existing law during that time, because they're going to see that the next panel could do the opposite, and then it would be the Wild West. So you propose a supermajority, but are we then going to be too reliant or too supportive of stare decisis? Could this lead to ossification in the law, that no one panel would feel that it was really empowered enough to make a significant change? And of course, that's where we get our landmark cases. That's where we get our Roe versus Wade, our Obergefell versus Hodges, or going back, Pennoyer versus Neff. When an existing court that's been there a while and that has a certain degree of continuity comes to a consensus that a significant change in the law needs to take place, are we not going to give the Supreme Court that same ability to change the law in the future?
So there's an important question here that that you raise with this that's actually a really deep one in constitutional law. And that's just, what do you think the role of the Supreme Court should be in our constitutional and political system? And I think for both of us, we think that the Supreme Court has taken on a very, very large role in our political process and in our constitutional system, and that it should probably go back to where it was throughout much of our history, which is having a slightly smaller role and less central role, and be a little bit more deferential of the political process. And so I think in that context, you know, we see this as a feature rather than a bug of the system, that what we want is a court that is there to do all the things that the court does well. But we don't think the court should be a central policymaker in our system, and that it should be much more deferential than it has been to Congress and to the president in terms of, you know, letting the political process go as it does. And that's part of what's important about being a constitutional democracy. And so, you know, it gets to very, very large questions about the nature of the court and its role in our system. But we see this as a positive thing.
Today, I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
Presidents have a right to nominate, just as the Senate has its constitutional right to provide or withhold consent. In this case, the Senate will withhold it.
When you go right off the bat and say, I don't care who he nominates, I am going to oppose him, that's not going to fly.
Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court. And tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Ganesh Sitaraman, who teaches at Vanderbilt Law School, about some proposals he and his co-author are putting forward to reform the Supreme Court, indeed, to save it. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Ganesh. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Ganesh Sitaraman of Vanderbilt University, all about his new article that's coming out, in which he proposes, along with his co-author, to change the composition of the Supreme Court rather radically. This will have many impacts. Among them is perhaps reducing the importance of the Supreme Court in American society. I'm hearing echoes of the statement that Chief Justice Roberts made back during his confirmation hearings in 2005, that all he is an umpire calling balls and strikes, and nobody goes to a ball game to see an umpire.
Yeah, we should have a court that is you know, less central to how our politics run, and that allows a democratic process to move forward. And I think these proposals actually push forward that in a very important other way that we haven't talked about yet, which is, you also won't have, when you have a rotational system like this, celebrity justices. What you'll have are a large number of people who are Court of Appeals judges who really aren't known and aren't public figures in the same significant way that many of our justices are. And we think that's a good thing as well, because it makes the law more about the law and less about the personalities.
So no more notorious RBG.
I think it's on all sides. You know, Justice Scalia was also something of a rock star.
Yes, he was.
Justice, and I think what we'll see under these systems is far less of a sense that there are these kind of celebrity justices.
I already miss some of Scalia's more pithy comments during oral argument, so there's a part of me that kind of likes the rock star Supreme Court justice. They make for good copy. One other question I had that I think I know the answer to now that I understand you better is that you pointed out that under this system, either one of these two systems, that justices of a given panel would not be able to choose the cases that they're going to hear. And under our current system, that choice is extremely important. I mean, the court's jurisdiction is essentially discretionary. And they pick cases that they think are important. I mean, they can say, here's the circuit split. The Sixth Circuit says this one thing. The Seventh Circuit says another. We need to resolve this, so we're going to choose a case that presents this issue. Now it's all resolved, and now we're all on the same page. Isn't that choosing function important for a court that's supposed to be unifying the law, at least federal law?
It's extremely important. And the court would still have that function. It just would be the rotating set of justices who are choosing. So in the lottery system, for example, every 2 weeks of oral argument, you would be hearing cases. You'd also be going through the cert pool and looking at potential cases and taking them. And what's striking about this, I think, and particularly cool about the proposal, is that I actually think you'll get a better set of cases going to the court. Because when you have a bunch of court of appeals judges who are rotating onto the court, they bring a closer to ground level understanding. Now, it's not all the way down at the ground level. They're not district court judges or magistrate judges, but it's closer to the ground level than the Supreme Court is of what's really happening in the court system. They might realize, hey, I've spent a year dealing with this issue over and over and over again, and we really haven't gotten clear guidance. And, you know, my colleagues on other circuits are hearing this too. We should really take a Supreme Court case on this question because it's a very important one. And that might not be transmitted in the same way to permanent justices who are really not in the trenches of doing the many, many other cases and broader set of cases that Court of Appeals justices see. And so I think you'll get a very important kind of diversity both regionally and of background and of expertise and of experience with different kinds of cases, which change in different regions. You know, so in some parts of the country, you just see a lot more of one type of case than you do in others. And that changes by circuit, most notably with the D.C. Circuit, which sees a lot of administrative law cases compared to other circuits. But I think that's an important piece of it, too, that we actually might see the court taking on more cases that help Court of Appeals judges resolve a much larger set of cases where there isn't as much guidance as the Court of Appeals might like.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, now that you mention it. So if I'm an associate justice during my period up in Washington, D.C., sitting on the high court, I look through the cert pool and I bring my perspective with me, maybe from out west or in the south or the northeast or wherever, and I say, this is an important issue. Here's a circuit split. Whatever basis for it, I can choose that. I can vote for it, and the court can choose that. But I just don't get to hear that case. Somebody else is going to hear that case. So essentially, I'm saying to the rest of the people in the pool of 180 associate justices, hey, guys, hey, gals, here's something I really think we should hear. What do you think about this? And that it will eventually be heard by a different panel.
Right. It'll be heard by a different panel, but it's at least been teed up.
Yeah,
and
we can
that's
still tee
an
up,
opportunity
right.
to get more things onto the court's docket that might be very helpful.
Very interesting. Before we leave, and I realize we're getting short on time now, to specifically address your balanced approach, the variant on this, you mentioned it would be a 5-5-5 system. You'd have five Democratic appointments on the court, five Republican appointments on the court. Would those be traditional appointments? Would those be people who sit there all the time, or are we talking about panels here?
So those would be traditional. Those would be similar to the current system where you'd have, you know, lifetime appointed sitting on every case like we do now. So effectively, we have five Republican justices now. We have four Democratic justices now. You'd add one more to the Democratic side. That would give you 10. And that's the five and the five. And then those 10 would choose another set of five.
Okay. Now I understand you. But doesn't that sort of cement in place the existing party system? I mean, I can hear all sorts of independents and Green Party members and other people gnashing their teeth and saying, aren't those two big parties already too entrenched? Don't we need to allow minority voices to come to the fore?
Yeah, so there are some issues in terms of how we think about the design of this. And as we said, you know, it's not to say that either of these solutions are constitutionally bulletproof, but we do think they are workable. You know, we have a system on many of our regulatory agencies where there are partisan balance requirements, and so that's one place where we've done something similar to this, not exactly the same, but similar. The other part of this is that, you know, we have a political process that operates here too. And so you're going to have a president, you're going to have a Senate majority and minority leader. Even now when we have independents, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Angus King, they caucus with one side or the other. If we had a very, very different political system, you know, something like what they have in Europe where there's proportional representation, where there's lots and lots of third parties that are part of Congress or part of their parliaments, you know, this kind of a system might not work. I think in the current context, though, it is pretty workable.
Very interesting. Well, again, I promised I'd let you out of here before you have to hurry off to your next speaking engagement. Any final thoughts before we go?
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. You know, I think what we're seeing is a lot of people are interested in debating these kinds of ideas. It's popping up in presidential campaigns already, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it. So I encourage people to check out our article in Vox or forthcoming in the Yale Law Journal, How to Save the Supreme Court.
Is that going to be available online, or do you have to subscribe to the Yale Law Journal to get it?
It's available. It's available right now on SSRN. It'll be available at the Yale Law Journal's website after it is published. But the draft is on SSRN right now.
Ganesh, thank you so very, very much for your time, and we really appreciate your speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Well, I'm looking across the table at one of my favorite faces. It's the quiz gal, and I think that means it's time for a quiz.
Hi, Stuart.
Well, hi, Emily. You're a woman of few words. How are you today?
I'm thinking I might need a kayak to get home.
Oh, yes. We happen to have a very rainy day in Virginia today.
Yes.
Well, but it's more important to do quizzes than to get home safely, don't you think?
Priorities.
Got to set your priorities. Absolutely. Well, we have Stephanie on the line. Stephanie, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not bad at all. Stephanie, where are you from?
New Orleans, Louisiana.
New Orleans, Louisiana. Do we have any questions in French? Cajun?
No, I
hope
don't.
No. Okay. All right.
It'll be fun, though.
All right. Well, Stephanie, you're up. Emily, have at her.
All right. Today I have a question for you about state powers. So which of the following scenarios would be considered an unconstitutional use of state power? A state passes a law that increases the pay of state legislators. B, a state enacts a law prohibiting smoking in all public places. C, a state places a tax on furniture made overseas. D, a state raises the drinking age to 25 years of age.
So which one of those actions by an individual state would be considered unconstitutional? Can we hear them again?
Of course. Unless Stephanie has already sorted it out.
You already figured it out, Stephanie?
I think I have it figured out.
Okay, which one do you think it is?
I want to say it's C.
C? Why do you think? What was C again, Emily?
C was that the state places a tax on furniture made overseas.
You think that's unconstitutional?
It's either, okay, I'm toss up between C and D.
Uh-huh. What was D?
D was a state raises the drinking age to 25.
Don't you think your state could do that?
But I feel like D is a federal law.
Oh, okay.
That it's 21.
I think there is, well, I'm not going to say anything about it, but okay.
But then I see, like, taxing on overseas products. In my head, I went straight to just, like, federal import tax type of thing.
Oh, I'm not going to talk her out of
and
that.
And I was like...
So I'm not going to talk you out of that one, am I? Emily put her out of her misery.
You're right. Don't let Stuart do you wrong. You are exactly right. Your first instinct was correct.
Yes, and do you know why that's true? Why did the putting a tax on something from overseas would be unconstitutional?
Was I right about the federal import tax?
Well, Emily, what was the explanation that you were going to give, or did you want me to give the explanation?
Oh, you go right ahead. You're the legal expert here, Stuart. I'm not going to step on your toes.
As a general rule, if states do things that impede interstate commerce or international commerce, they're treading in areas that are very dangerous, and that might be interpreted as a violation of something we call the Dormant Commerce Clause, or it might, as you say, simply be an infringement on areas that are reserved to the national government, the national taxing power. To be perfectly honest, I've never specifically thought about this question before, but one way or the other, I'm pretty sure that there's an unconstitutionality to it, which is why I wanted Emily to explain it, so I wouldn't have to admit that I'm a little uncertain. But what I can tell you is that all the other things were perfectly constitutional. Well, occasionally I have to look things up. And I think I have found why this would be unconstitutional. In Article 1, Section 8, the Constitution reads, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States." And so if state number one could do its own duty, its own import tax, then it would be possibly at least unequal as compared to the other states.
Almost certainly. Plus, okay. Then you'd end up affecting commerce when Philadelphia lowers the tax rates in their port and New York doesn't.
I mean, just a couple of clauses down in Article 1, Section 8, you do get the Commerce Clause that has Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations. So I'll give myself that much credit. I was on the right track there because that would. I mean, if you had individual states taxing German products at different rates, that undercuts Congress's commerce power. So I don't feel too bad about that.
And as we all know, the Constitution has to rein in those wily states.
Indeed it does. Okay, well, now at least we have an explanation for something that I wasn't sure of. So there.
We all learned something today.
We all learned something today. So even if you didn't know that there's some problem with this international tax, you could have eliminated all the other answer choices. And so C is correct. And so congratulations.
Yay.
Send us a message on our Facebook page and give us your T-shirt size and your address, and we will have a pocket constitution to you along with a YWC T-shirt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Quiz Gal.
Thank you, Stuart. Remember, the Constitution's for girls, too.
While James Madison is best known as the loudest and most powerful mind behind the U.S. Constitution and its subsequent ratification, his social behavior suggested otherwise. Madison was short in stature and quiet in conversation, listening more than he spoke. When Madison was 30 years old, one of his peers mistook him for a recent college graduate. A foreign diplomat, upon meeting Madison, suggested that he had been silent for 2 years. One wife of a Virginia congressman even described Madison as, quote, "the most unsociable creature in existence," end quote. But such behavior was all part of Madison's unwavering work ethic. He had near perfect attendance while a member of the Virginia Governor's Council and as a delegate at the Constitutional Convention. Some biographers even attribute Madison's decades-long bachelorhood to his dedication to public service.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Ganesh Sitaraman of Vanderbilt Law School, who's written an article with a co-author, Daniel Epps of Washington University Law School, all about how to save the Supreme Court. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.